Hello, everybody. Thanks for coming along to the October 5th Pony Sync Call. And we're off to the races with RFC number 23, which is the string formatting RFC. This is Theo's RFC. And basically, it's ready for vote. Anyone have any comment on it?
My comment is that I love it.
You know what? Me too. So I'm going to go ahead and merge this unless anyone has anything they want to say otherwise. Theo, do you hate your own RFC?
No, I like it.
All right, good. Then let's merge it. All right, that's in. I don't think we have anything else that is in voting, not yet. Although there's some that we should probably think about moving forward to voting. For example, unique promises.
Yeah, I have to come back to that one.
Okay. And I owe everybody some work on number four, the sugar for method chaining. Just for a little context at work, I've been doing a bunch of F-sharp work and dealing with the way that pipelining works there. And it's nice. So that's a good thing. How's that for context? Not very interesting. I think we will move on to PRs then. So let's look at PR 1270. Okay, so that's interesting. Malte's got some comment on there that I did not see since last week. So we're gonna have to look into this, it looks like. Malte's comment doesn't seem to indicate what the heck is going on there. And it sounds like, does anyone know if his fix? I'm a little bit confused because he doesn't need to reproduce it. He needs to reproduce that it doesn't fail with his fix. Maybe he means that he can't make it fail without his fix in Bad Pony?
Yeah, I think that's what he's saying is that he doesn't want to add a test because the test doesn't fail before the patch is applied. But I mean, I don't know. I can go either way. Like I don't really, I don't know.
Yeah.
Nice to have a test in there, but if it doesn't reproduce before the fix, maybe we don't need to,
throw it in there.
Well, I don't know. I kind of think that this is, in some ways, I'm going to say it's low enough priority that let's just figure out what's going on. Like, we don't need this thing to be thrown in. Take some time to figure out why it's doing this thing.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for volunteering, Andy.
Is that what I just did here?
You totally did. And actually, in honesty, I think you're probably right that we should probably have a look at that, because I am confused as to why his fix would work. Because it appears to me that that's happening after we've already gone through ifdef normalization.
Yeah, it feels.
And so it feels like there's some other underlying bug. So there you go. So let's have a look at 1278. Looks absolutely correct to me.
I think it was, based on the comments, I think it was pending adding tests.
Okay. I see. So it is. On the other hand, there should be SSL tests in there already, right?
It also needs a change log entry.
Ah, okay. That is true. Thank you. Okay. Ah, and he's saying that there's not. Okay. Then I guess we should probably delay for now on that one. So let's have a look at 1283. Mostly because I think this is an easy one. Which is to say, it requires Andy to answer Joe. Or rather, actually, answer Theodos. Andy?
Sorry. My answer would be that I wrote this when I was first learning Pony, and so there's probably no good reason for that none to be there. I need to look more closely at this, but
yeah, no, I think there is a good reason for the none. The remaining question is about box versus val for the lambda type.
Yeah, exactly. The none is actually a quite clever thing because it allows for collections of none, particularly where none is an element in a union type that you have a collection over, right? Which is the interesting case.
If this was a clever thing, Sylvan probably came for me.
I actually don't think it did. But
let's see here.
The actual question is about
the box versus val on the lambda. Shit. Again, I'm going to knee-jerk and say that it was probably me not knowing enough about Pony at the time to write it that way. So if it works with box, then I'm going to assume that it was just me being dumb, or not dumb, me being ignorant.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything asynchronous in iter tools that would require the lambda type to be sendable, right?
Yeah,
no,
exactly.
I don't think there would at all.
All right, cool. If everyone's all right with it, I'll merge this one. What do you think?
Well, where does it stand with box versus val? I didn't check and see.
I was just looking through there for lambda types.
Looks like box is used.
Yep, box is used, which is good. Because it is more permissive.
Sounds good.
Excellent. Merging. Squash and merge. All right. So let's have a look at 1279. It is marked do not merge, but also needs discussion. So let's have a look.
I think the main thing is Sean wanted confirmation about whether this was an appropriate approach.
Okay. Let's have a quick look. Yep. So a start process authorization. And make sure that it takes process monitor off, which is either ambient or start process. And importantly, we check for file exec on file path caps. And check the mode on the file info for the file path. Okay.
Yeah, and then Sean's remaining question was whether we should be using something other than cap error when it's the executable mode that's the problem.
I actually think that's fine.
Yeah, I think it seems reasonable to me until somebody comes to us with a use case that they say this needs to be differentiated because.
Right, and until then, it is actually a capability error. That's a capability that's unavailable with that file.
Yeah, it's like we're pretending that we have a capability to secure a file system.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, exactly. In process, we do. I'm tempted to merge this, even though this says do not merge.
Oh, Sean will be so mad.
How about we just mark it with a little thumbs up?
All right, sounds good. Then what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull off the do not merge and the needs discussion tags. And I'm going to say... wait, what happened to the GitHub mark you as having reviewed?
I still see it. Are you logged in?
I am. I swear to God. I am logged in.
I can just hit it for both of us.
All right, thanks.
I mean, I'll just, say that both of us.
Sounds good. All right. Well, you're marking that up. Let's swap over to issues. Let's have a look at 1280. That's interesting.
Yeah, so I wasn't even aware that that this was a feature for classes.
The reason this works with classes is that field initializers are inlined into every constructor. There isn't a separate set of code, if that makes any sense. They're simply run in sequence in each constructor.
Right.
And in this specific case of an object literal, those field initializers are treated slightly differently, right? Because they're grabbed from the enclosing scope.
Yeah, they're passed in.
They're treated as constructor parameters.
Right.
So that's interesting.
So the class example, is that like a feature or an accident? I think that's my core question.
It was intended as a feature.
Okay.
But perhaps we should treat it as an accident. That is to say, the idea was that this would allow you to arrange your fields such that if there was dependent initialization, you were still able to initialize outside of the constructors.
Okay. I mean, that seems reasonable. Yes. So
you could do things like have a default size, initialize a default array to that size, think that sort of behavior. it's certainly not required, right? Because anything that you could initialize from an expression, you could reuse that expression in the next thing, but it would be more verbose.
Yeah, so I suppose the next question would be if it would be possible to do such a thing for object literals, make it so they could pull from
either
scope.
So,
like, for example, in this case where the let y would go in the constructor rather than being a constructor parameter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In fact, they could both go in the constructor. In this example, they could both go in the constructor because zero is just a constant.
Right. Neither is captured.
Yeah. So we just have to distinguish in the compiler whether it's captured or not, and only then make it a constructor parameter.
Yeah. So, yeah, you're right. So this happens in sugar.c. Or basically between lines 840 and 849. And the issue here is that this is long before type checking. So there's no way at this point to determine if what we're closing over does or does not depend on things that are outside of the scope of the object.
Yeah, and I guess even in the case if we were to go down this rabbit hole, we could potentially get into a situation where somebody expects it to kind of work both ways. Mm-hmm. Like to have an expression, an assignment expression that uses a captured variable as well as one of the other fields, and in that case it would be hard for us to know where to put it.
Yep.
And we'd have to do some more analysis to find out that this part is captured, so that needs to be a constructor parameter that we need to pull in and then use it in this expression. It probably gets hairy pretty quickly.
That you're absolutely right. It is possible to make those distinctions, but then you get into a more complex way to do the equivalent of lambda lifting in a functional language where you need to do a lot more type inference about what the types of things are and what scope they're in before you start lifting closures. Whereas in Pony, we're able to do this for an object literal in the sugar pass. So, to argue against myself, this kind of late binding is why we treat partial application differently from object literals, and we pick up partial application much later in the type check. And if we were to pick up object literals much later in the type checking, in a similar place to where we pick up partial application, then we could would have the context to be able to go through the initializer fields and determine exactly which variables were being closed over and pass those in rather than passing in the initializer expressions. Because there's another interesting thing with objects, which is that those initializer expressions are calculated before the constructor is called, whereas you might expect them to be calculated during the constructor execution, if that makes any sense.
Right. And they would also be constructed. No, never mind. That would be expected.
Yeah. That makes really essentially no difference at all for an object literal that creates an object, but it does make a difference for an object literal that creates an actor. If the object literal has behaviors on it, where you might expect those expressions to be executed asynchronously. Probably not that big a deal. Just trying to figure out what is the most consistentist approach.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like that approach that you outlined of pushing back the object literal into a later pass, I guess the expression pass where everything else is.
Where every other damn thing is done.
Yeah, could be that kind of sounds like the ideal solution in terms of consistency and correctness, if it's possible, but it also sounds like a chunk of work.
It's a chunk of work, yeah.
For something that is kind of tiny.
Yeah. I don't mean to be dismissive of it. It's worth thinking about.
Yeah, like I wouldn't necessarily want to call this a won't fix, but maybe it's like a difficulty hard, priority low sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe that's the... Yeah, that's a good call. That's a good call.
So, and you're fairly confident that it would be possible to do it in the later pass?
So the issue in the later pass is that you would have to take the initializer expressions. Oh, it would be properly hard. Not impossible. What you'd have to do is... Ooh. Huh. Actually, that's gruesome. Because the issue is we're going to create a new type, right? So if you look in... where the heck is the partial application? Probably it's the function called partial application in call.c line 529. So in partial application, what we're going to end up doing is creating a new lambda type, which is another form of object literal, during the expression pass. Now, if we were going to do that for an object literal, and we wanted to track which variables were closed over, we would want to make sure that we weren't type checking those expressions inside the object literal until we were handling the object literal itself. Ouch. I'm just trying to think what the cleanest approach to this is, and I can't think of a clean approach off the top of my head.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds similar to a lot of the dead ends I ran into while I was trying to improve various bits of usability for lambda types. Lambda expressions. Because you need the type information available to determine whether, you know, what kind of capability the lambda can be and all that stuff, but you're using that to determine the type of the lambda, so it's all just the type, the expression type pass is just sort of filled with everything that needs to happen, and it only sort of works if things can happen from a depth-first perspective.
Right. Yeah, and it's a complicated depth first in this particular case because we're actually lifting that type. So when it happens in sugar, it's really straightforward. that type is lifted, it's compiled as, with a hygienic ID, we're done. And it's a very different approach from trying to determine what was closed over. It's sort of the same core problem where in lambda expressions, we explicitly close over things.
Right.
Rather than allowing implicit closing. And, okay, so maybe that's the way to think about this, is that allowing implicit closing over state in a lambda is equivalent to this problem.
Right. So you're suggesting that perhaps object literals should be amended to have explicit closing? I don't think that's going to be very popular, but yeah.
I think that would suck. No, I'm actually going the other direction. Because I think that would suck. I think possibly the right way to do this is to think of allowing implicit closing in both lambdas and object literals and figuring out a nice consistent way to do both.
One possible concern that might come up with that is Pony's no shadowing rule.
Mm-hmm.
If we allow implicit closing, we either allow shadowing or we break. I'm pretty sure a lambda will currently compile if you introduce a variable with the same name as the one in the outer scope. Because it's not a problem because you're bringing in every bit of explicit scope that you need.
Right.
And in this case, if we allow implicit scope, then I think we'd start breaking use cases and you'd have to, use more primes, I guess.
Use more primes. I think we could do it without that, but it would lead to the classic ambiguity of something might or might not be shadowed, right? You would get a situation where there could be uncertain shadowing inside a lambda or an object literal. But we could still do it without requiring the primes, because what we could do is say the first thing they're looking for is closing over stuff, and that finding which stuff is closed over has to take into account local variable declaration. So if there's some X in the outer scope and you've bound a new X in the inner scope, then you haven't closed over the outer X. And then we would type check the lambda having not closed over the outer X, and the use of X before the new binding would be an error because you have not bound it yet, right? You haven't said let X equal anything yet.
Right. I mean, it makes sense to me. I think it. I mean, you could probably say that that is allowing shadowing. I mean, I personally don't have much of a problem with shadowing as long as it's all like locals. But I mean, if Pony does have a stance as a language against shadowing, I think, I don't know.
Yeah. My stance against shadowing is purely pragmatic and in no way philosophical. Philosophically, I think shadowing is absolutely fine. It's just that pragmatically, it's usually a bug. I don't think, maybe I'm just trying to defend a position because it sounds attractive to me, so don't take this as in any way firm, but I think I might claim that doesn't count as allowing shadowing because you couldn't both close over the variable and introduce a new binding. It would have to be one or the other.
Right.
But, you know, I'm not sure. Maybe that's a crappy way to look at that. Interestingly, Pony's stance against shadowing happens in like one line of code in scope.c. So that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think shadowing can be useful and helpful, you know, for the programmer to sort of use it when it's appropriate. But yeah.
Okay. Well, that's, you know, that's something
I don't want to force Pony to bend to my own whims if it already has a stance.
This is a young language, and it must think about all things. So that's something we can definitely revisit. Actually, let's take a quick straw poll on that. What does everybody, how does everyone on the call feel about variable shadowing? Or any kind of shadowing, right? It could be method name shadowing, anything.
I'm against it.
All right. I like a nice firm stance.
Yeah, I think what Pony does is nice. It's definitely caught me a few times when I've almost done stupid things.
Yeah. That's how I feel about it, is that every time Pony has yelled at me, I've gone, oh, crap, that's true. I really don't want to shadow that.
Yeah.
I feel like I've often wished I could shadow a method with a local variable.
You're the guy who rides a motorcycle without a helmet, aren't you?
No, I'm the guy who writes Ruby in his day job. Even more dangerous.
Inherit everything. Just inherit every type. Okay. Anyone else? Kevin? Theodis? Bueller? No? No opinion? Or are you just talking while muted?
It sounds like you know what you're doing.
Famous last words. Okay, I think the comment on 1280 is that this is deeper than we thought, and I think we should look at allowing implicit closing over variables in both lambdas and object literals. Sound good?
Yeah, I think we should at least look at it.
I'll make a comment here.
So our next neat discussion issue would be 1275.
I'm going to keep discussion on that, and I'm going to mark it as difficulty hard. Enhancement. Oh, actually, enhancement needs discussion. Take off the discussion during sync call, and priority low. No offense on the priority, but it's not going to kill anybody. All right. Right. What's the next one?
1275. I'm not sure why Sean Marcus says needs discussion during sync. I think maybe I would just call it bug needs investigation.
Okay.
I'm just going to go ahead and make that change. We can talk about it now if we want to.
Okay.
If anybody has any bright ideas, but I think it just needs somebody to figure out what's going on.
Damn. Straight up bug. There's no reason that should fail.
I think all that's marketed is needs investigation because I don't necessarily want to spend time on the call.
Okay,
doing that investigation live.
Right. Yeah. Okay. All right. Let's have a quick look at 1273. All right, and let's have a quick look at this commit and see what the deal is. Oh. Forcing IPv4 was a problem on AppVar. All right, let me leave a quick comment here. Okay. I suspect this is due to deep Windows voodoo about when IPv6 is available and when it isn't. And personally, I'm inclined to mark this as closed. And that's an absolutely fine fix.
Yeah, okay.
Just for context, everyone, I had originally forced IPv4 to fix a network test, the network test on Windows in a different context, which was running Windows in a VM that thought it had IPv6 connectivity, but didn't. And so it would try and pull an IPv6 address, and then the test would fail when it was fine and when it did v4. So the specifics of that may or may not be an underlying problem with Windows. But I suspect not. I suspect it's that it was strange behavior of the VM, not Windows, so that it had something to do with VirtualBox lying to Windows. And it could have even been the way that VirtualBox was configured, as in it had a net adapter, a virtual net adapter configured that it shouldn't have had or something like that. So I'm going to close this one.
Yeah, some monster lying in AppVar's system too, perhaps.
Indeed, right, which is totally something that we will just accommodate and not attempt to fix, if that were the case. All right, so let's skip down to 1261. Oh, that's rather clever. Nice catch. So this is interesting. Because file errors are complex and annoying. And we have sort of two routes that we can go overall for the standard library. One is to say that file errors should be very exact and should report as much information as possible. And then we require large pattern matching statements for anyone that is interested in taking action based on the error. And the other is to say, go away, it really doesn't matter. Once there's an error on your file, there's nothing, not a darn thing you can do about it, so why do you care where the error came from? We will return less succinct errors, less precise errors, and you will lose information, but you won't require large pattern matching statements on the other side. Because I am an old-fashioned C programmer and basically wrong about everything, I lean towards the latter, which is to say, once it's failed, I really don't care why. It doesn't really matter. I'm going to handle all errors probably in the exact same way anyway. On the other hand, there's a reason I preface that with, as an old C programmer, I am wrong about everything. Any opinions on the call?
Well, I mean, I don't know. With the system that includes type unions, it sort of seems like a bit of a false dichotomy, right? Like you can have, you can choose to do the precise large pattern match, or you can just say, you know, was it a file error of any kind?
That's true. Or even, was it this specific one? Else do this more general thing.
Right.
That's a very good point. That's a very good point. In that case, I would be more specific about permission denied. And report it as a file, a new type, something like file cap error. Based on John Brown's comment. So the test in question is it's the line 266 in file test pony, right? Yeah. Which is, that's such a good catch that's going to succeed when you're root. Because it's just going to let you. Interesting. Chmod just could. Well, I see. Chmod could be called on the file path, I believe. Yeah. Anyway, that's not important. Since we already have one, that should probably be called directly on the file path. That's not the thing in question. Yeah, I think the right thing would be a file cap error. Joe, do you want to make a comment since you kind of nailed it on the more precise errors thing?
To be honest, I don't follow where that line of discussion fits in with this. I thought this was just about making the test more portable. I don't know.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I see your point.
I mean, yeah. So maybe I'm not following some part of that.
No. I see your point. Is that, yeah. That his question, yeah, that John Brown's question doesn't address the core problem, which is that this is still not going to be permission denied once you're root. And in fact, once you're root, I don't see a nice way to make this permission denied. Okay, I'll make a little comment here. I'm really not sure how to. Basically, I think I would be okay with removing the test. In the, it's a small enough case that I don't see a way around that. Detecting root isn't a good cross-platform solution because the way Windows works, you run that with admin, with admin permissions, and trying to figure out when and when you don't have admin permissions on Windows. Well, it turns out there are lots of other ACLs that might allow you to do that, when, even though you've taken away permissions with Chmod. Because of the fun of the way Windows handles that. Yeah. If anyone else has a better solution to this, please, please pipe up. The only thing I can think of is to give up on it.
Yeah, I mean, my only thought was, if we had a some sort of different error other than permission denied, that we could use, because I think it's just trying to test that file that the constructor for file will come back with an error no of some kind. So, if we could get it to come back with some other error no, but.
Yeah. All right. Well, if you think of something, leave a comment. Otherwise, let's look at 1256. Because I can answer this. Yay. So, 1256, the issue is that it is a documentation bug. And that the documentation for Pony Continuation should say that it's only safe when the actor pushes a continuation to itself. So the real world use case is that there is another programming language that is written on top of the Pony runtime, which I don't know how many people are aware of that. There's a programming language called Encore, which is the product of a joint research effort between Imperial College, Uppsala in Sweden. I'm a bad person and I can't remember which. I believe it's Utrecht in the Netherlands, but I might have the wrong university there. In which case, I apologize to you Encore people. That's extraordinarily rude of me. And they've built a very interesting research language on top of the Pony runtime, and they use the continuation feature. I had thought that at some point the ability to push continuations in Pony was going to be useful and important. And as far as I can tell, it turns out I was wrong and that Pony will probably never need that. As usual, Ben was right that it would be incredibly expensive to make it match the documentation. So I think we will make the documentation match the implementation and say that it's only works when an actor pushes a continuation to itself.
Do you have a link or way for me to look up the Encore language project? Just if I search on GitHub, will I find it? Or,
you know, that's a good question. They have kept it relatively private, as is unfortunately often the case with academic languages. It looks like there's a Git book if you search Encore language on Google. It looks like there's a Git book, but I can't
That'll be good enough. I'm just trying to type up a comment that captured what you said.
Okay, cool. It doesn't look like there's any content on that. There's some Atom syntax highlighting for it. Oh, I do wish more of that were public. It's an interesting research language. And has led to some quite nice formalization work on the Pony Garbage Collector.
So just for context, what is the purpose of a continuation in the
runtime? Yes, it's to do the thing that both you and I think is fundamentally a bad idea for Pony, which is to say the ability to rewrite a behavior to allow it to await the arrival of some message,
right, and
process a continuation. Okay. So in Encore, they have blocking futures as a language primitive. And the way they implement blocking futures is using continuations.
Right, that makes sense. I just wanted to make sure I had the full context. I'm going to try to take that down in the issue ticket.
Awesome. Thank you. And then I think we can close that one. Well, no, we should fix the documentation.
Yeah, I'll do the labels for it.
Awesome. Thank you. So we're running out of time, but let's have a quick look at 12:48. Yes, the pointer in maybe pointer is indeed misleading. Benwell's right.
Yeah, and I remember for a previous discussion when we settled on the name maybe pointer, because the previous name was misleading.
Yeah. The previous one was maybe, and people thought that they should be applying that to all sorts of types.
Oh, yeah, as in like A or none.
Right. Exactly. That is exactly the thing, is that people kept stumbling on maybe and going, oh, that's clearly what I want. That's very similar to an option type in Haskell or something like that. And the confusion was very much my fault and not anyone else's for the crappy name I gave it. I think Chris's suggestion of not really a struct but could be is the best possible type name. That's really good.
I like that too.
Should I just add the turn into RFC label and open it up for somebody to do an RFC for a rename?
Oh, yeah.
Because we do think it needs to be renamed, right?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. I think if we can mislead Chris, of all people, then we need to rename it. All right. We have theoretically run out of time. Is there anything that people want to discuss before we end the call?
There is one thing I wanted to... Oh, looks like Andrew was about to speak up. What do you say, Andy?
Oh, I was going to say no.
Okay. What have you... There's an RFC that I brought, and I just wanted to sort of get a reality check and see if it's something that's technically feasible before we continue discussing it.
Awesome.
Let's see, where is it?
38?
RFC 38.
All right.
So the basic idea is allow you to use the embed keyword for an actor as long as you're embedding it in another actor, and then it would act like basically that it just becomes sort of like an internal piece of the outer actor, and they share a mailbox.
Okay.
Such that you can create abstractions of actors that can call synchronous methods on the interactor if the interactor exposes a synchronous API, because the outer actor would have a ref reference to the interactor.
Wow. You're breaking my brain. Okay. So it's your...
So the basic idea would be that it's laid out in memory in... Just like the embed keyword signifies for a class, it's laid out in memory in the outer actor.
Except it wouldn't, you couldn't, because you don't want the interactor to have a heap or a message queue or any of those other things. So what you'd want is to strip it of all of those things, essentially compile it as an embedded object, and then move its method, move its behaviors onto the enclosing actor with as a delegate that forwarded to the behavior handlers, i.e. the code gen behavior handlers, on the embedded actor. Is that right?
Well, actually the delegate part is something that I think should not be automatic. Basically, I would want to hide the internal actor inside the outer actor. Like, for example, a use case for this is like wrapping a TCP connection actor and being able to expose behaviors that don't look like you're using TCP. It looks like you're just passing in objects and then they get serialized and sent out the internal TCP connection.
How would that TCP actor be notified by the ASIO thread with an event notification?
Right, so it would have the same mailbox as the outer actor, and they would be atomic together.
Okay, but then we need a way to distinguish the correct receiver in a mailbox. And we also need a way to distinguish the message ID, i.e. the VTable entry number, for a behavior on an embedded actor versus a behavior on a wrapping actor. Does that make any sense?
Right, yeah. So, you know, I am personally like fuzzy on the bits of information that the mailbox actually uses and needs. So
right. So okay,
that's
cool.
Why I'm bringing this up.
Yeah, totally. Why don't I just cover that briefly so that you know what it does? So that's the message queue stuff, and that's handled in actor.c. And it's remarkably small, actually. So if you check out pony.h, and you'll see there's a base type defined for a pony message T that has two 32-bit numbers and a pointer. Now, real messages are actually bigger than that because they contain some data after that. But essentially, the beginning of any given message will look like that.
Right.
Where the index is a way to know how big the total message is so we can free it to the pool allocator. And the ID is the vtable entry so that we can turn around and dispatch it correctly. So there's no receiver or sender-based information in the message itself. So when we handle the message in actor.c, line, well, roughly 85, where we do some stuff about being blocked, and then we go through and we call the dispatch function, passing it the context, the executing actor, and the message. The dispatch function is codegened on the type, and basically what that does is it switches on the ID and calls the correct underlying behavior. The reason it's codegened is so that we can compile a really damn efficient switch. Yeah.
So one of the reasons I brought this up is because I was wondering if it's related in any way to the implementation that would need to be done for async lambdas.
Ah, what an excellent question. So an async lambda would be implemented, no, will be implemented as a magic message ID. So another thing to show, because it's show and tell day. In actor.h, lines 14 to 19, there are some magic message IDs. And they're garbage collection related. So block, unblock, acquire, release, conf, and act.
Right.
So an async lambda could be encoded as a pony message T that had a pointer to the lambda itself, i.e. the object that has the apply method that is going to do the thing. And a magic message ID, uint max minus 7. And when any actor received a uint max minus 7, we would say, oh, that's an asynchronous lambda. We're going to get the lambda out of it, and we're going to apply it, passing it the message would be the async lambda and the arguments to the async lambda, not just the async lambda. Turns out arguments are going to actually be really useful. So we would pull the async lambda and its arguments, and we would basically call the apply function with the arguments. And we wouldn't even care who the receiver was, right? Either your receiver was already closed over or whatever, right? The receiver doesn't even have to participate in that.
Right. Isn't that the same kind of we're adding like a special case for an extra layer of indirection that could be employed for something like this as well? I don't know.
So possibly, yeah. So we could have a message type that was, theoretically, we could have a message type that is a message within a message, right? Mm-hmm. Where it says, oh, we're sending it to you, but really what this is going to contain is another message T and
a receiver.
And a receiver. But we're still going to need to be able to send those messages in the first place. So if we're past the address of the embedded actor, we would need to somehow, because currently when we send a message to an actor, we don't need to know anything other than the address of that actor, because it's got a message queue at a defined place relative to that address.
Right.
And all of a sudden for this thing, it wouldn't. So, well, on the other hand, that's not entirely true, because we code-gen the send methods, right? So for every behavior, we have actor behavior that we code-gen and actor behavior send that we code-gen. And that handles allocating a pony message T, slapping everything we need into it, and putting that on the correct queue. So we could have, for the embedded actor, the idea of Oh, I know I'm an embedded actor. Oh, God, that gets tough. Because then we're code-genning the type completely differently when it's embedded compared to when it's not.
Right.
That's... I've suddenly talked myself into thinking that's quite hard indeed.
Right, but it would be a separate, like, reified type, right?
It would, yeah. I'm just thinking, how separate would it be? Would it have to be reified by context? And it would, because otherwise how would it find its queue? It doesn't know, there's no magical place where that queue is relative to the pointer. So for every embedded actor, we would be having a different reified type that knew how to find the correct queue to embed onto.
And the when you're talking about where the queue sits, you're talking about the actual queue sits at that location, not a pointer to the queue, right?
Yeah.
Because I was going to say that they could, the embedded actor could have a pointer to the same queue at the same relative location in memory. It would have a pointer to the same queue as the outer actor.
Right. Currently, there's no indirection there.
Okay.
Yeah, they're pretty tightly packed to avoid indirection like that because you don't want to pick up the cache miss when you send a message. The extra cache miss, I should say. You can still have cache misses when you send a message, of course, but not that one. Huh. Now, so the particular case that you brought up is interesting to me because you still want to do things like receive event notifications from ASIO, but you don't necessarily want to allow sending other kinds of messages to the TCP actor. You would rather treat those, I think, as synchronous calls when it's embedded. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, so you're talking about basically so that, I mean, that one implication of, I think, where you're going is that the you would not be allowed to take your reference to the internal actor, convert it to a tag, and send it to somebody else.
But, yeah, that would be incredibly difficult in the type system as is to stop from happening. Yeah.
Yeah, you'd have to have some kind of special case logic for that makes it kind of inconsistent.
Yeah. And we have a situation where the APIs of actors will be assuming that their synchronous methods are only called by the actor.
Well, yeah, in the current paradigm, yeah. The actor or, if it has a notifier, they could be called by the notifier. Or, like, I wrote up a pony pattern for just adding B access, like an access behavior that just lets you pass in a lambda that gives a ref reference to the actor to that lambda as an argument and lets whatever sort of synchronous operations you want to do on it, like as a transaction.
Yeah.
So I think there's already sort of some patterns for actors exposing synchronous APIs, but
Yeah.
It's just interesting here because I would like to, be able to send, send objects to an actor and have those objects be serialized and go off on a TCP connection.
Right.
But this worked in the case where what I wanted, where I could sort of abuse write V and then mutate if I was just accepting an array of byte sequences, I could abuse write V and mutate the ByteSeq iter internally so that it is actually different than what the user passed in.
Right.
But in case of just serializing an object, it's not so simple.
Not as straightforward.
Having two layers of actors.
Yeah. Huh. Now, another approach, which is far less general than what you're talking about, but perhaps useful, I don't know, is to think about what if we should, maybe what we should be looking at doing is taking the logic in TCP connection and creating a class out of it, and then having a TCP connection actor that knows how to deal with that asynchronously.
Right. Yeah, I've thought about that too. I've also thought about the notion of using type parameters to allow, like, to add, basically add methods to TCP connection that would let you pass in objects of type A. Uh-huh. Have them be serialized according to some, you know, mechanism.
Right.
And then when your responses come back, they come back as type B.
Yep.
Deserialized properly.
Right. That makes sense too. That makes me feel like maybe that's even more of a reason to pull that logic into a class and say, here's a synchronous one and here's an asynchronous one.
Yeah.
And then,
and so basically you would have to have your own ASIO notify method.
Yep.
On your own, sorry, behavior on your own actor.
Yeah.
And you would invoke the class internally. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll probably think about this a little bit more and take a look at the message queue code and see if I can think of any bright ideas.
Sounds good.
But I'll also look at the TCP connection class idea.
Okay, cool.
Which is something I was already looking at, but I thought maybe this would be more general.
It would be. You're absolutely right. I'm just, it's not quite, it's not fitting for me. I'm not saying it's wrong. It's just not fitting for me. I'll think about it too, because it is an interesting thing. The other possibility, of course, which we should raise, because we should always raise it, is do we want to allow inheritance? Because there are all sorts of ways that Pony could allow inheritance in the mix, in the sort of the mix-in sense, rather than the way C++ does it, that would work. I don't like inheritance. I tend to find that everywhere inheritance is used, I would prefer a different way had been used. But I cannot give you an argument that is actually rational for that, right? That's just my feeling. I don't have any proof of that.
So I forget, can you put behaviors on a trait?
Yes, you can.
Yeah, so I mean, you could kind of already create a reusable TCP connection trait that that just you had to you'd have to give it places to hook into your.
That's true. Yeah. That's absolutely true. And so if we had some kind of trait for the TCP connection actor and we had a class for, that managed the actual TCP connection state, that might be pretty good, actually.
Yeah, because I mean, I think in the cases I'm thinking about don't really call for inheritance so much as they call for composition.
Yeah, definitely.
Which is more in line with Pony's paradigms anyway. So.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, your case is very much a composition case. It's a, I want to compose with this thing, but I do not want this thing to be asynchronous, and it is written as an asynchronous thing.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. I really hadn't even, it had never crossed my mind until this conversation that someone would need a synchronous version of a TCP connection. But you do. You clearly do. And you've got a really good use case for it.
And Sean was also bringing up additional concerns about, well, how does this fit in with TCP listener? Like when TCP listener needs to return, your notifier needs to return a TCP connection, but how do you get it to return your wrapped version instead? Is another bag of worms. But anyway, I think we've dragged this all on long enough, probably.
Okay. Yeah. I'll make a brief comment on that, is that if we did the same strategy of creating a TCP listener class and a TCP listener actor, then customizing that TCP listener behavior to return a specific kind of connection would be trivial.
Yeah.
So that's interesting.
I'll probably bark up that tree a while.
Okay, cool. All right. On that note, we've gone way over time. Thank you, everybody, for being so patient. And also, thank you for coming along. Last chance. Is there anything that anybody needs to go over? Okay, cool. See you all next week. Take care.
Have a good afternoon, everybody.